This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With summer coming up, I'm already dreading not only the traffic on the roads, but also the increased cost of groceries and the fact that my children eat all day long. You know, we all have stressors. Some are big and some are small, like an increased grocery bill. But therapy is a safe place to actually get these stressors off your chest and to figure out how you can actually work through them. There are many benefits to therapy for people from all walks of life. It's helpful to learn positive coping skills so you don't freak out about that grocery bill, and how to set boundaries. Therapy can empower you to be the best version of yourself, and it isn't just for those who've experienced major trauma. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's convenient, flexible, and entirely online. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/Russell Moore today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Russell Moore. Welcome to the Russell Moore Show. I'm Ashley Hales. I get the privilege of producing the show. And today is one of the episodes where we are chatting about your questions and Russell's answers. So thanks so much, Russell, for showing up for our listener questions.
I can't wait. I always enjoy hearing what's on the mind of listeners.
It's wonderful. I love rooting through and finding out some good questions. We have a lot of hot topics today for our episode. A grandfather, Chad, asks about gun reform. As you know, we have seen, of course, tons of mass shootings. He asked, does the church as the representative body of Christ have a moral and Christian obligation to engage in calling for gun reform? He says, just as we did in the abortion debate. So he's asking also for, you know, what sort of community forums and public accessibility might the church provide to begin to have a conversational platform to seriously address the issue?
You know, this hits really hard for me right now. We have some dear friends whose children survived an awful school shooting here in Nashville. And so many people affected by those who die that are very connected to us. I think there are a couple things to keep in mind here. I mean, I think on the one hand, we do have to recognize there is a difference between the United States and almost every other Western country, in the sense that we do have a Second Amendment, and that the Second Amendment is important. Now, having said that, the Second Amendment is not does not give an unlimited right. I mean, and we all agree on that, actually, because we know that individuals do not have the right to nuclear weaponry or to a tank. There are all sorts of things that individuals don't have a right to have or to exercise. So we agree on that point. What we also need to keep in mind is the Second Amendment, a well-regulated militia necessary to the maintenance of a free state, that required a certain kind of responsibility in a community for those who are bearing arms. So that doesn't give an unlimited sort of sort of right. And we're at a point right now where even the most minimal and common sense sorts of restrictions. I mean, I think about one of the conversations here in Tennessee after the school shooting has to do with simply giving a mechanism for a family or friends to be able to say, we have somebody in our family we're very concerned about psychologically. They shouldn't have access to guns. can be appealed, can be worked through, but having that mechanism, and there are many people who refuse even that. Yeah. Even the most minimal sorts of background checks to make sure that you're dealing with people who have not given evidence of being dangerous. I mean, it's very, very minimal things that have become part of this culture war sort of conversation. Yeah, yeah. I think for mm-hmm. the church, I think we have to speak with some moral clarity, saying what is happening right now is wrong. When children all over the country are doing active shooter drills, something has gone really, really wrong, and we have to come up with some solutions to get us there. Now, are there going to be areas where individual Christians are going to disagree as to how that ought to be carried out? Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. there are going to be some Christians who are going to say, have a very maximalist approach, and some who are going to have a more cautious approach. Those Christians need to be in conversation with one another and moving mm-hmm. forward. But mm-hmm. I do think we have to say that the situation we're in right now, my friend David French had a piece in the New York Times about gun idolatry, and he's a Second Amendment, very strong Second Amendment guy, but he says there's something that has gone wrong when there's this kind of fetishizing of guns in a way that just it's not happening at the time of the writing of the Second Amendment. It's not, you're not having Christmas cards with children in AK-47. So something's gone really wrong morally mm-hmm. and personally there. I think we have to address that as well.
Yeah. Agree. You know, as we think about just some of the implications and some of these kind of cultural war topics, there's of course the idea of critical theory as well. You know, you had Christopher Watkin talking about how do we create a framework for understanding the Bible and apply that to all of life with the title Biblical Critical Theory. And so that conversation listeners might want to go back and listen to. But, you know, there is a question particularly about why does the far right fight this idea of critical race theory? Is it a bad idea, or is it just uncomfortable in conservative politics? And then a wider question about, you know, when you see certain issues in one side, one political party that you are amenable to as a Christian, and yet in the other political party you might see other things, how do you even know how to vote? So critical race theory and voting, all in one question.
Well, let me take the second one first.
Sure.
If that's the case for you, if you see some things appealing in one party but other things not, and the reverse, you're actually probably in a healthy place. Because otherwise what you end up with is a kind of inerrancy of your political party, whatever it is. And so I think when it comes to understanding how to vote, a lot of that has to do with sorting through, what are the priorities that I see? What are the likelihood of moving the issue along in the way that I'm concerned about? And what's the character of the people for whom I'm voting? Are they actually going to be able to, with integrity, carry out leadership? So there are going to be people that I would disagree with on a lot of things that I would say I can trust that person with the nuclear codes. And there could be somebody else that I would say I agree with this person a lot, but I can't trust that person with the nuclear. I mean, so you have to sort that through and do your best when it comes to voting for specific candidates. When it comes to the other, I mean, the other question, the critical race theory question, is complicated because we're dealing with two completely separate things. So if you're saying, do I agree with critical race theory as it's really defined? No, I don't. But that's that's not what we're debating in school boards around the country, and certainly not what we're debating in churches. Instead, often what is labeled as critical race theory, and I was labeled a critical race theorist, which is kind of hilarious to me in some ways.
Yeah,
but it's because if you're defining critical race theory, I had a, when I was president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, I had a meeting with a group of Baptist leaders who, one of them said, oh, what about your critical race theory? And I said, okay, before we talk about that, what is critical race theory? And he said, well, it's whatever you are thinking and doing. And I said, well, then I am a critical race theorist by definition, if whatever I'm thinking and doing is that. But what it typically, in the way that it's being used politically, means is somebody who believes that there is injustice both at a personal and at a corporate level, and that both of those have to be addressed. And then since then, it's become even more. So you have critical race, anti-critical race theory laws being used to get rid of books, children's books about Ruby Bridges, or compilations of Letter from Birmingham Jail. I mean, those sorts of things, that's an atrocity. And what you end up with is whenever somebody asks me about critical race theory, it's kind of like, I use the example of if you have a congregation where somebody's going around and saying, we need to be concerned about Unitarianism. Let's oppose Unitarianism. And what they mean by Unitarianism is that the pastor got up and quoted from Deuteronomy, Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one. Now, on the one hand, I'm opposed to Unitarianism. I think Unitarianism is wrong. That's not Unitarianism. So if I were in a congregation where that is going on and people are coming up and saying, will you pass a resolution with us against Unitarianism? I'm going to say, no, if what you mean is that the pastor ought not to quote Deuteronomy. So we have to define what it is that we're talking about here. And this has been used really craftily by some people who, in some cases, frankly, are white nationalists and white supremacists or adjacent to that, who want to be able to have something scary that they can say without having to actually say what they mean.
Right. And they can keep using that word as kind of like the bugaboo, you know, to that's going to jump out at us. Any advice on how to stay sane in the midst of some of that swirling around in churches?
Well, I think at the church level, in some cases, that has already come and gone and moved on to the next sort of way to attack people. And I think the way to stay sane with it is to say, what is obedience to Christ? What does this look like? And I think that that requires a vision of justice that biblically defined is both personal morality and corporate and public responsibility for justice. Do that when people call you, whatever they're going to call you, you can't really help that. You just have to press forward.
This episode is brought to you by Church Law and Tax. Church Law and Tax understands the realities of church work, helping thousands of churches stay informed and get equipped with comprehensive resources on legal, tax, financial, and risk management matters. Do you have a question on housing allowance? Need information on selecting church insurance? Looking for insights on what is or isn't unrelated business income? Or how about some guidance on how to properly receive charitable contributions? ChurchLawAndTax.com equips you for success with access to the most respected and knowledgeable attorneys, accountants, financial advisors, and risk managers guiding churches today. Get the practical information and timely coverage you need to keep your church up to date and lead your ministry with confidence. Join ChurchLawAndTax.com today.
Well, with all of the increasing news about artificial intelligence and people quitting from Google and, you know, what does this next iteration of our social lives look like? One listener writes in to ask, what is the impact on Christians and the way we read and study scripture? She's particularly worried about AI and the way that it might distort the truth of scripture. And how do we live given these realities? What does it look like to kind of engage with questions of AI, but not unthinkingly take it on? And what might that do to our value and study of the Word of God?
Well, I think, first of all, the AI that we're dealing with right now is we're kind of at the Pong level of video gaming.
Yeah.
I mean, it is, we are so at the very beginning of this, or the dial up internet
era
of it.
CDs.
So we don't really see exactly where this is going. There's nothing that you can do to say, let's stop artificial intelligence. We are moving into an AI era. I'm really worried and concerned because nobody at the policy level seems to know how to get a handle on this in terms of regulation. And probably won't until this is so ubiquitous that it's unregulatable.
Right.
So I'm concerned about that. I don't think, and I wrote about this one week in the newsletter a few months ago, I don't think that artificial intelligence is ever going to be able to replace teaching and Bible preaching. And it could, if what we think preaching and Bible teaching are, is conveyance of information.
Right.
Instead of actually having somebody who is wrestling with the text and then in the act of bearing witness to that text is creating an experience. With Jesus through his word, that can't be replaced by artificial intelligence. So now, will it bring both benefits and detriments? Yeah, I think that in a lot of ways, AI will bring tools for people in terms of understanding the Bible in the same way that, say, the internet does.
And I
know somebody might say, well, yeah, but it can lead you into error. Yeah, that's exactly right. If you don't know how to discern between truth and error, then AI is going to be a bad place for you. The internet is already a bad place for you. The printing press is a bad place for you. So you have to be able to do this. But there are all kinds of ways, in the same way that, say, right now, there are pastors, Sunday school teachers, and missionaries who might not have access to a library of resources to be able to study, to prepare to teach, say, Malachi chapter 1, but they can use digital tools to do that. I think that AI is probably going to help with that. I'm scared of it in all kinds of ways. I don't think we're ready for the things it's going to change, but it will bring some helpful resources there, I think.
Yes. Have you been following along with Jonathan Haidt's Substack, where he's kind of working through his book, Data?
I'm embarrassed to say that I have not seen that, and I need to.
You do. I'll give it to you later. But he did recently write about that, where he'd had several policy meetings with folks, both on the tech side as well as kind of the mental health sociological side. And he had a few ideas about regulation. So hopefully we got some smart people thinking through what to do next.
Well, I'm glad, because John is one of the few people who sort of from the very beginning saw what social media would do, especially to adolescents and particularly to adolescent girls. So That's cheering that he's paying attention to this.
What I loved most of all about Israel and why I became a Zionist was because Zionism was a rejection of victimhood.
A few weeks ago on CT's The Bulletin, we launched Promised Land, a new podcast about Israel and Palestine in a post-October 7th world.
6:30 a.m., we're in our synagogue praying, and sirens go off, and they're going on.
Based on interviews and conversations captured on the ground in Israel last November, it's an exploration of the spiritual, political, and historical roots of the conflict.
When there's a weak Israel, every Jew in the world is weak.
And why should a Russian Jew who has nothing to do with this land come here? Why? Well, I mean, if you want, you can give them Texas. You love them so much.
I am alive because I didn't come home. But all my friends that were here were murdered. Here, over there.
This week, Promised Land moves to its own feed. You'll find links in the show notes. So if you haven't heard it yet, you can go catch up and catch the new episodes as they come all in one place.
Our last question really has to do with another hot topic about abortion and how might we really work with our context in ways that are both empathetic and understanding and yet also really value the lives of unborn children. So a pastor writes in, he is pastoring in a more liberal area of the country, that a lot of the areas seem entrenched around issues of abortion. And he's wondering, would a more libertarian approach to the conversation politically be better in the long term? He says, I want to fight for the rights of the unborn and preborn, but I also feel like some of the extreme laws put up barriers. How can I be a gracious, loving voice for biblical change in my community, in my church, and in my family?
Well, I think one of the reasons why, as somebody who is committedly pro-life and has been all along, one of the danger points we find right now is that there are always people who want to disconnect the persuasion aspect of the pro-life conversation from the public justice aspect of it. So you will have, and that can go in either direction. So there will be a lot of people who will say, well, I don't like abortion, but let's try to persuade people not to have abortions, but let's leave it legal. Sort of the safe, legal, and rare kind of argument. I don't find that persuasive at all, because I think the ultimate problem is casting one group of vulnerable human beings as invisible. So the persuasion alone without public justice is, I mean, and we can do this with anything. I mean, there are all kinds of people who say, well, we don't need integration, just work on people's hearts. And ultimately they will, you also see a lot of people who are focusing on legal and public policy wins without persuasion and the changing of hearts and minds, which can lead to a backlash in which you end up with a situation sort of analogous to what Jesus says with the cast out one demon and seven more come back. Right. Could be in that situation. You have to have both of those things. So what I would say is, if to this pastor, is the people that I have seen who do this the best are people who have been working in this area at the local level. A lot of times people have no idea who they are, but they're the people who know how important it is to actually connect with people in crisis. And they also understand and know that it's not enough just to convince somebody that abortion is an act of violence, which it is. It's not enough just to convince them that we're dealing with two people in a pregnancy, not with one, although that's true. because there are all kinds of people who can believe those things. Right. And when it's their situation, throw all of that away. So they know how to persuade people. And I would also say to that pastor, you have to show people, bridge things they already know and care about, to show them how they actually already do have a category for this. And so I've had to do it in different contexts from both ends. So a lot of times I will be talking to people who are very pro-life when it comes to abortion. They don't care about the kids in foster care around them.
Right.
Or they don't care about the refugee camp down the road. And what I have to do in that situation is come in and say, okay, you have a category for the sanctity of human life as human life. You have a category for vulnerability and protection of vulnerability because you believe that when it comes to the pro-life issue. So don't do to these people what you see as wrong when it comes to abortion. Then in other contexts I've been where you have people who are very devoted to human rights, to vulnerability. They're concerned about children in poverty. They're concerned about refugees and immigrants and other things. But abortion, they don't want to talk about that. You have to come in and say, okay, this is what you already care about. And all we're asking you to do is not to look away from this person. And that's ultimately what all of us are dealing with when it comes to this question of human dignity. Who do we want to look away from? Who do we want to pretend like is not there? And simply to move on. And so that takes persuasion and it takes working for justice at the same time.
Yeah. And that just really leaves us with such a question that each consider is, who are we not seeing? And may God open our eyes to pay attention to the people and the issues that we're ignoring.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. It's always a pleasure, Russell, to chat with you about listener questions.
Yeah.
Thanks again.
And I hope that anybody who has questions about anything, send them to us at questions@russellmoore.com. And they don't have to be big.
I know. Heavy. These were very large, hot topics. But you can just say, Russell Moore, what are you reading? And what did you have for lunch?
Fish tacos today.
Feel free to submit your questions to us at questions@russellmoore.com.
That's right.
The Russell Moore Show is a production of Christianity Today. Executive producers are Eric Petrick, Russell Moore, and Mike Cosbert. Hosted by Russell Moore, produced by Ashley Hales. Associate producers Abby Perry and Azrae Phelps. CT administration provided by Christine Kolb. Social media by Kate Lucky. Director of operations for CT Media is Matt Stevens. Production assistance provided by Core Media. Audio engineer is Kevin Duthu. Coordinator is Beth Grabencourt. Video producer is John Rowland. The theme song for The Russell Moore Show is Dusty Delta Day by Lennon Hutton.
Every day, CT testifies to the reality that Jesus is alive, transforming his world and bringing his kingdom to bear. Jesus transforms, CT equips. Make a gift to our nonprofit ministry with a gift of $20 to provide 150 more people with redemptive storytelling, global perspective, and thoughtful podcasts. Give now at morect.com/equip.